2FM.
The Republic of Ireland versus Portugal. A game on special.
Game on 2FM. With Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's new high protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Thanks to Jenny Green for entertaining us this afternoon. It's Thursday the 11th of November and this is Game On. Coming up today, we're live at the Aviva Stadium with full match commentary as Ronaldo and co take on an Irish side that almost caused a shock the last time they met.
McGrath to take this corner then on the left-hand side. Yes. And Ireland scored! Republic of Ireland lead and it's Egan! What a goal for John Egan and what a time to score it in the 45th minute. Lovely corner from McGrath into the 6-yard box and the few Irish supporters who've managed to get into the ground celebrate. And John Egan, the man from Sheffield United, the 28-year-old, has put Ireland ahead.
We'll also get you up to speed on Stephen Gerrard's return to the Premier League with Aston Villa. And in rugby, Bernard Jackman on the Irish team Andy Farrell has picked to face the All Blacks.
He's making sure that we're in a position to see the opportunities that's in front of us. What we do know against the best team in the world will be there'll be limited chances, you know. So the one thing that has to happen against the best team in the world, when you get your chances, you have to take them.
We'll take a trip down memory lane for fans of Clare Hurling. And if you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Right, so welcome along to the Aviva Stadium. I'm in the company of Tony O'Donoghue and David Snaid and soon to be 52,000 football fans as well. Tony.
We're football fans too.
We are. We are that. It's exciting. It feels exciting.
It does. There's an event happening here tonight, isn't there? You can feel it outside the stadium already. I saw kids waiting for the buses to arrive. There's hawkers selling their, plying their wares. And there's a great sense of anticipation in this great old stadium. We're really looking forward to it.
There's a sense of anticipation for a few reasons. Obviously, Ronaldo coming to town is one, but also the fact that Stephen Kenny and this Ireland team are getting to play against Portugal in a sold-out Aviva Stadium.
Yeah, of course, like even like what Tony was mentioning there, even coming in, like the grafters, the Ronaldo scarves already are flying off the shelves, but when we arrive there, like it's all quiet in here. But Gavin Bazunu, one of those players who was exciting so many players, even as a goalkeeper, that performance against Serbia, I think, went down and really kind of galvanised the crowd. But it was interesting to see him when he walked out. He walked just over to the penalty spot there in front of us, kind of had his ear pods in, was listening to the music. I remember going to his house after he actually signed for Manchester City and chatting to him in the sitting room, and he spoke about his love of the Wolftones, the Dubliners, how he loves that kind of music, but that he has a playlist before games that's completely different. He wouldn't say what it was, but it was to bring his heart rate down. It was just to relax himself and to bring it down, and I think he's shown on these occasions that that's what he does, and he can really perform. And there's been other players now in the last little while who've come to the fore. Obviously, unfortunately, Andrew Omabandeli won't be playing tonight. He's one of those who almost scored an absolute scream, or I think Tony might have been out of a seat as well when that had went in. But you're right, there's definitely the Ronaldo factor, of course there is. There's Portugal, like a superpower of football coming to Dublin for a match when people have been starved of loyal football, haven't been here. Like Lansdowne Road, it's going to be packed, it's going to be absolutely hopping here later. And I just really hope that the Ireland team can put on a performance and really add to that.
It's interesting what you say about Bazunu and the Wolftones and the new Ireland, if you like, taking shape in this team. Stephen Kenny has clearly done tonight what he had been doing, most interestingly, in his Dundalk notes as well.
The programme notes.
He's written about, in his notes, the question of identity, culture and new horizons are both prevalent and relevant to the Irish international team. Who are we? Who do we represent? And what do we stand for? What are our values? It's clear that football represents all of the strands of society in Ireland. This Ireland represents the four provinces and the diaspora in the UK, as a high number of players have come from the schoolboy clubs and our League of Ireland clubs through the international system to become senior internationals. I think that's fantastic. I mean, you know, sometimes we'd like to welcome the players and officials from Portugal. to hear something from the heart there as well. You know, Stephen Kenny is wearing his heart in his sleeve as he does, and he's now publishing it in the programme as well.
And he's connecting with people. Like, he is connecting, and this team is starting to connect. Tony, I know you have a young son who's going to be here tonight. I know that my son's soccer training was cancelled tonight as well, and like, that hasn't happened for ages. Obviously there has been COVID, but there has been games, and they haven't seemed to resonate with them, but this team is now really starting to resonate with people, David.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Listen, there's been a lot of disappointment over the last campaign. Like, Ireland, no matter what happens here tonight, Ireland aren't going to be going to the World Cup, and that is a big disappointment. But the bigger issue here at play is what's going to happen for the future of Irish football. And I don't think it can be underestimated from the low of Luxembourg and where Stephen Kenny was at there. That probably was the nadir in terms of this campaign, and the way he has managed to galvanise the players. I don't think it's gone unnoticed by people high up in the FAI that it could have easily gone off the rails after that, but he didn't. He's kept people together, he's kept this group of players together, and most importantly, he does seem to have a support base with those fans who've been here. And like anyone who was here for the last 15-20 minutes of that Serbia game, when Serbia could have been out of sight if it wasn't for Gavin Bazuna, who was mentioned earlier on, but they really did galvanise behind the team. We're talking there that those programme notes that Stephen Kenny spoke about, and that emotion and having that depth of feeling towards the country and what it means, I don't quite think that has been there in years gone by. But like, let's not make a mistake about it as well. There's people coming here and they want to see Ireland play well, they want to see Ireland do well, they want to see a continued progress. That did seem to be there away in Azerbaijan, and in that friendly win over Qatar here, when it was really good just to see an Ireland team put on a really impressive performance and outplay a team who weren't on Ireland's level. But so often has been the case over the last number of years, we play teams that haven't been on our level or what we feel aren't on our level, and we're the ones who look so par. It's going to take a bit of time under Stephen Kenny to get this right and to have it exactly where he wants it. A big night tonight that will hopefully go some way to making sure that he does get that contract for the next campaign, and then hopefully again seeing some of these players he's brought through getting more club football and improving even further.
And Tony, Stephen himself said it's the kind of night where everyone wants to play. No player wants to miss out on a night like this. What are his big selection dilemmas?
Well, yeah, there's a problem for me in that this is the glamour event in many respects, but the most important game is the one on Sunday against Luxembourg. I think that will be a better barometer of whether we've made progress. Have we made progress against teams that are ranked lower than us, who've come here and beaten us? I mean, that was the most disappointing result of this campaign. And how many players, I mean, we talked about Seamus Coleman in the past, can he play two games in 4 days?
He's spoken about that himself, hasn't he? He's mentioned the fact that Seamus Coleman has issues with his hamstring, so has Matt Doherty. It's been very rare where the two of them have been able to play back-to-back games, or even in previous windows when it's been three games. I was having a little chuckle myself there when Tony was talking about the glamour game. I was seeing the signs up for the cup final with Pats and Bowles, and I was kind of thinking you were going to say something about that as Pats go to win the FAI Cup.
That's selling really well as well, by the way.
Bohemian selling 16,000 tickets in an absolute flash, like that hopefully now as well. We're getting a bit off tangent, but that could be another serious occasion here, and hopefully it will be a great way to finish off the year with two brilliant Dublin clubs battling out for a cup. And but I just make the point, I think Tony is right in terms of say the Luxembourg game, but I think with 52,000 people here later on and the crowd and getting a big performance at home in front of so many people.
Exactly,
100%. And that's what Ireland need to do. They need, put on a show, but put on a performance that kind of shows that what Stephen Kenny and his coaching staff are doing is getting through to the players and sinking through to the players. We had it this week, Josh Cullen coming out very, very wholeheartedly and supporting Stephen Kenny, and not just giving the usual platitudes that you would expect of a player, but someone kind of explaining what he's trying to do and why it is so important that Bob Marley coming on. But
Bohemians get everywhere.
I know, I was just going to say, yeah.
You mention it and then they start playing it. That's what happens. Stop.
That's the balls effect.
Because, Tony, look, 52,000 people, when things are going well, you feel it. But when things aren't going well, you can feel it as well. You can just sense it.
And I'm urging a bit of caution as well, Dave, because you're very optimistic, and I can see why. And I'd like to be that optimistic person as well. But Portugal are ranked ahead of us. They've got quality in every position. Yes, they've got players who are on yellow cards, maybe that'll be a consideration when we see their starting 11. They've got players missing through injury, Bernardo Silva in particular, Mendes suspended, but it's still a team that is better than us on paper,
of course, yeah.
And likely to be better than us on the pitch. They didn't perform as well as they expected to in Faro, and we performed probably above ourselves. That was a surprising performance, but unfortunately didn't bring with it the result. So I'm not expecting Ireland to win. I'm hopeful.
Oh, come here, listen, I think let's be honest, if Ireland aren't at it, if Ireland aren't at their absolute maximum tonight, and Portugal are, Ireland could get a hiding. There's no getting away from that. That could happen.
And then that brings with it all the question marks about the Stephen Kenny era, regime, coaching, etc. Has he given young players a chance too early? I mean, the game where Conley, Ida and Parrott played was perhaps in hindsight a mistake.
And only one of them, there could be a situation, only one of them you would expect will start tonight, that'll be Adam Ida. He was very impressive in Faro. But then he could also be dropped. He hasn't been in on Norwich. Will Stephen Kenny look at it and think, do you know what? Callum Robinson scored 5 goals in the last window, he'll be that focal point up front, because when you look at why Ireland were so impressive out in Faro, was having that ability either side of Adam Eady, who was very impressive, of hurting them down those flanks, because with Kinsella on one side, they were pushing up and Ireland were able to get in those spaces. Callum Robinson hasn't got the pace on one if he plays off him to really do that. So would someone like Ogbeni be possible to be thrown in there? Jamie McGrath had an exceptional game out in Faro. So there's definitely decisions in the team will be coming through soon enough, and I think that'll give people a greater insight into what Stephen Kenny's thinking is. But yeah, like there has to be obviously cautious optimism. Of course, like the way this campaign has gone, you can't have anything else. But these on a night like this is a stage where that Ireland player should be embraced, and that's the message. Everyone knows what Stephen Kenny is like with that Dundalk team, what he did with them, and how he was able to get them to rise to the occasion and that amazing Europa League run. And that's what he needs to get out of these players tonight. And as Marie said earlier as well, put on a show, but just put in a performance where he can actually put it up to Portugal like he did away from home.
We know that Omar Bamadeli is unfortunately missing for this game at least. Maybe he'll have recovered in time for Sunday. So yeah. That's I reckon he would have started, because he started all the games he's been available since he's come in for Dar O'Shea against Portugal in Faro. So a decision has to be made there. Will Seamus Coleman come in as one of the three, the right-sided centre-half, where Matt Doherty plays, because he played on the left against Portugal the last time, and to have somebody with his defensive nous but his ability to get forward as well. And he's played very well on the left, by the way. So that's a decision to be made. And then who plays in midfield? I think Cullen and Hendrick are nailed on.
Yeah.
So is it McGrath? Is it Horahan?
Right, well, we will bring that team news to our listeners as soon as we get it. But Tony, David did mention Dundalk, and I know you're going to need to run off very soon, but the club is now back in local hands after the Peak Six decided to sell it on.
Yeah, and I think it's something that can be everyone in Dundalk, I think, is greatly relieved. The Peak Six era, even though, you know, they did get a couple of trophies, but the chaos at that club since Peak Six took over. I mean, I could give you 100 examples, not one or two, of interference of people, unsure of their roles, of a strange transfer policy, the way the contracts were given and taken away. It's been a soap opera. It's been an absolute circus. And the fact that the likes of Andy Connolly, who's been involved before, is coming back, I think, and Martin Connolly, people like that, who care about Dundalk and who deeply care and have a connection with the area, with the club, it makes me wonder about, you know, in England they have a fit and proper person test. Now Peak Six are getting involved in Wolverhampton Wanderers, it seems, as well, and they've been involved in other clubs. But the Peak Six that we saw in Dundalk seemed to be Bill Hulsizer, the father of one of the directors of Peak Six, taking a particular special interest in the club, an unhealthy interest.
It was like a plaything for him.
Yeah.
It wasn't serious at all. He came in saying tensions, with all these intentions about qualifying for Europe, and they did. That's the thing. They actually, despite all this chaos, and when Filippo Giovagnoli was in there, they got into the Europa League group stages. I think then once they realised that it wasn't an easy book to be made, their interest just went. Decisions were made, and the place was a shambles. And like, they went from a point where Dundalk under Stephen Kenny, that's the reason why he got involved, because of what he did, and when he thought they were able to make a few quid, and it wasn't possible. And they've gone from a point of strength and a point of power where they're now playing catch up to other teams. And it's going to be an interesting winter now to see what happens, see who stays in charge and what can happen for next year, because it's been a shame what's happened to the club. Fans have been disaffected, and it'll be a happy Christmas for them, and it's about time. But it just shows you what Tony was saying about how you have to kind of wonder about people who come in, and I don't think it's wrong to be wary when they come in espousing X, Y and Z and they just don't deliver on it, and then as soon as they lose the interest, the club can almost disintegrate.
I think Moneyball has a lot to answer for, you know. Finance people looking at stats and trying to impose a particular model. Sometimes there's a theory of chaos. I mean, I suppose it works for Abramovich to an extent. Maybe it worked for Watford to an extent, chopping and changing. And
well, wasn't Brad Pitt played in Moneyball? Would you reckon he'd be playing you in the Irish version?
Listen, there's been some great times with Dundalk. That's the pity. And I think, you know, Shamrock Rovers need to be challenged. We need more than one club doing things properly, and I hope this is an important day for Dundalk Football Club and for the League of Ireland.
Yeah, well, you would hope so anyway. It'll be interesting to see how they do get on next season. Tony, thank you so much for joining us. We are going to stay with football, and Fergal Brennan is going to join us now to talk about Stephen Gerrard and his new job with Aston Villa. Fergal.
Hello.
Good to talk to you. So look, big news today that Steven Gerrard was confirmed as the Aston Villa head coach. It had been muted for a couple of days. Just from your own perspective as a journalist on Merseyside, do you think this is the right move for both Steven Gerrard and Aston Villa?
I think they've essentially caught each other in a bit of a sweet spot. Steven Gerrard's stock is pretty high based on the success that he had with Rangers last season, winning the title and breaking that long streak of success that Celtic have been on. And he's, as I say, in terms of his kind of coaching development over the last few years, he's now reached a little bit of a peak. Aston Villa, despite the fact that Dean Smith's been sacked on the back of five defeats and they've slipped down the Premier League table, they're still an ambitious Premier League club. They're still a relatively historic club in the context of English football. They have money to spend. They'll look to spend in January and look to get themselves back on track and push for a European place. In terms of how it will work out further down the line, obviously that's always difficult to predict, but I think Steven Gerrard has built himself a reputation. The kind of so-called golden generation in that England team have not done particularly well. But it'd be unfair to throw Gerrard in with that block, because up against lads that he used to play with for England, he's done comfortably better. That being said, with the greatest respect to the Scottish Premier League, the English Premier League is a completely different ball game. It's going to be a big challenge for him, but he's a very ambitious individual. Whenever you hear him speak, he's a very determined type of character, and you look at the way that he used to play, dominating in Liverpool's midfield, England's midfield, he'll bring that to this role. But it's going to be a real test of just how good he actually is in what's a really early stage of his managerial career.
And just in terms of the future, I know we don't have a crystal ball or anything, but does Steven Gerrard need to do this? Does he need to have a spell in the Premier League to be in with a chance at someday managing Liverpool?
I think so, yeah. Whether that's right or wrong, I think that's the way the narrative goes. I think so much attention is on Gerrard to be the long-term replacement of Jurgen Klopp. Whether or not that comes to pass obviously also remains to be seen, but I would never see him going directly from Rangers to Liverpool. There had to be a bridge in between, and probably nine times out of ten you'd say that would have to be another Premier League club to demonstrate that he's been there and done it for maybe two, three seasons, that he knows the league and he gets a bit of a grip on it. I think if that is his overall game in terms of long-term looking to manage Liverpool further down the line, then yeah, I think he has to take at least one Premier League job in the meantime. And it'll be interesting to see how it works out for him, because he has established himself with a fairly solid reputation in Scotland, but it is a completely different scenario now. And Aston Villa are having a difficult few weeks, so he needs to get in there, get things settled, get them back on track, and then look to build from there, probably moving into the start of 2022.
The reality is, Fergal, that it might not work out. Like, they're just above the drop zone, so it's not like it's going to be plain sailing for him, and I think they're still probably trying to come to terms with the loss of Jack Grealish.
Yeah, and I think this is going to be the test of Gerrard, because Gerrard's style with Rangers was that he was such a kind of force of personality. He was a good coach in terms of implementing changes tactically and that type of thing, but it generally was his will of personality that he had all the players dragging and pulling in the same direction. In the Premier League, his coaching attributes will be tested a bit more. We know that players will probably get on board with him. He's a Premier League legend, an icon for probably a lot of these Aston Villa players, particularly the English-born ones. The coaching side of it will be the big test for him. There will be no issue in terms of motivating players to perform and play for him, but there's going to be a lot of questions asked about him. And as you say, they are in a difficult position. There's a list of probably around eight teams in the Premier League that could get sucked into a relegation battle further down the line, and they're right in the middle of that. So in terms of motivation, driving the players on and being a bit of a figurehead for the club, he's a fantastic choice. It still remains to be seen tactically, coaching-wise, whether the level that he's at the moment can cut it in the Premier League.
Yeah, he has a difficult apprenticeship now to serve in the Premier League, for sure. David Snaith is with me here in studio, or in the Aviva Stadium, and he has just spotted his first Manchester United jersey. Ronaldo on the back.
I know. Just despairing.
No sign of Ronaldo yet, though. We are keeping an eye out. The Portuguese fans are starting to come in. Ireland fans are starting to come in as well. It's filling up pretty nicely, and it's set to be just a fantastic night. Fergal, the night is just beautiful. The sky is black, and it's dry, and it's clear, and it's all just set up for a really good game of football. We hope, though. What are your thoughts on it? Give us a little bit of a removed view on how you think it's going to play out.
I hope it's going to be a win. I do. I mean, obviously, as you say, a nice evening. Great to be back in a full Aviva. You want an Ireland to win. Obviously, World Cup qualification's not on the table anymore. Portugal have still got plenty to play for. Their place in Qatar is not assured, so it's going to be a test for both sides. But that positivity was re-injected back into Ireland in the last window with the Azerbaijan and the Qatar wins. You get the sense now that there is way more positive momentum moving around the team, moving around Stephen Kenny. Portugal are a really difficult side. Obviously, they're one of the best in Europe, and they still want to make sure that they get Qatar ticked off. But you do get the impression that Ireland can get a result tonight, and you just get this sense that sign off 2021 with some positivity, a positive result tonight, maybe not a win, even a draw, and then a win against Luxembourg in midweek would be massive, and it just makes things kind of snowball a little bit smoother into 2022, and then focusing on what's next for Stephen Kenny and the players.
We are awaiting team news. It should be with us shortly, but there are a few reservations about whether or not Seamus Coleman should start a game like tonight and maybe keep him in reserve for the Luxembourg game. What are your thoughts on that?
I think, again, it depends on managing these injury situations. Stephen Kenny's mentioned this in the week in terms of two games back-to-back based on the hamstring problem he's had in the last couple of months would be a little bit of a difficulty. I would always kind of go with the slightly more old-school view of it. Seamus Coleman's captain. He's Ireland's best player, or arguably Ireland's best player, up against a team like Portugal at home. I would play him. He's an inspirational figure within the team. He's a key player in terms of the tactical plan that Stephen Kenny wants to put out. Play your strong foot forward tonight. Luxembourg, in reality, I know obviously the low point of losing in Dublin to them earlier on in the year was a difficult one to swallow, but play Seamus Coleman tonight, look to go for a positive result. In reality, Ireland should have enough to beat Luxembourg away from home with or without Seamus Coleman. So I would love to see him in the starting lineup tonight. It's always brilliant to see him because it means absolutely everything to him to walk out there with the armband on, and obviously with a full stadium tonight, it just seems kind of tailor-made for Seamus Coleman to start and to have a really good performance.
Well, Fergal, ask and you shall receive. The Ireland team has just been tweeted and Seamus Coleman is in there and he's captaining the side, and Callum Robinson will be supported by Jamie McGrath and Shadazi Ogbeni in attack.
You did. I called it. It was interesting to give him beforehand, like when the players did come out, Nathan Collins might have been in with a chance. He had a big massive smile on his face and he was chatting with James McLean, who also seemed to have who seemed to be in good spirits, but the two of them are on the bench. It's an interesting one. And the Stevens coming in, you know, he's kind of falling out of the picture a little bit. Kind of had a really bad injury with Sheffield United, was out of the mix when they kind of got relegated from the Premier League. He's gotten back in there now, he's playing, so like that'll be interesting to see how Enda Stevens does on that side. But I think Ogbeni coming in, that I think is a signal of the intent what Stephen Kenny has. I mentioned earlier about Adam Eda and the focal point that he provided out in Farlow, but it's clear now that Stephen Kenny feels as if that Callum Robinson around CR7 is contractually obliged whenever you mention him, especially when Ronaldo's around, that he's able to do the same kind of job and holding the play up and causing causing an issue. It will also be interesting to see what Portugal go with. Like, they will 100% have one eye on Serbia. That's the game for them. If they win that game, they top the group to go through, regardless of what happens here tonight. That's their main one. They've got players on yellow cards like Cancelo, also like Ruben Diaz, so it'll be interesting to see if those two are arrested. But for Ireland fans who will be coming here now and that team now will be getting drip fed to people outside, it's clear Stephen Kenny has an intent to attack on the break, try and soak up pressure. Having that control in the midfield and staying tight with the centre backs and the back and that unit in defence is going to be key. It's going to be massive. And then if they're able to do what they did in Farlow and have those little breaks in those pockets of space on either side, that's where Ireland got a bit of joy. It's what led to the goal. Oh, sorry, it was led to the corner, which led to the goal. So that does seem to be the intent, looking at that team, and it's a serious occasion for Chidozie Ogbeni, who's at Rotherham in League One and has come to the fore as well a little bit, and it's a show of kind of supporting him as well. So it's an interesting team. There's a couple of changes which I was not expecting, but we will see how it copes. And the big thing for Ireland is having control out of possession and out of the ball and being able to suffocate the service into Manalo.
Okay, well, we will be continuing our build up very, very shortly. David, thank you so much. Fergal, thank you to you as well. We're going to take a very quick break now.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Healthy dinners made easy with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range. Available in selected stores nationwide.
The Republic of Ireland versus Portugal. A game on special.
Welcome back to the Aviva Stadium for the Republic of Ireland against Portugal. It is starting to fill up here very, very nicely. Lots of Portuguese fans are already in situ and we're all here waiting for a glimpse of Ronaldo. We have seen the Ireland team already. We've seen them as well walk the pitch and get to know it a little bit more before all of those fans come in. We will update you when Ronaldo does land on the pitch. But now we are going to turn our attention to rugby because we are also building up to the Ireland rugby game against New Zealand. And there is one change to the team for that test. Ian Henderson comes into the starting side to take the place of Tadhg Byrne. Otherwise, it is as it was for the game against Japan, which Ireland did win. And now to talk us through the team, I am delighted to say that Bernard Jackman joins us on the line. Bernard, we weren't expecting a huge amount of changes. If there was one that was expected, it was Tadhg Byrne to drop out and Ian Henderson to come in.
Yeah, it makes sense, to be honest, looking at that New Zealand pack. They're very powerful, particularly their front five. So Henderson's a slightly bigger man, more of an orthodox lock, and I think it gives us, you know, a little bit more power and size to start the game. But obviously Tadhg Byrne will have a huge role to play, whether that's coming on as a replacement second row, or obviously potentially he can come on in the back row as well at six. So yeah, I think we're very lucky to have three top class locks in Byrne, Ryan and Henderson, and yeah, it's a selection based around the opposition as much as anything else.
Yeah, so about the opposition, they have also named their team a huge amount of changes, but just in terms of how Ireland match up, when you do see them on paper, we've changed now our attitude to New Zealand quite a lot over the last few years since we have started to beat them. But how do you think this Ireland starting team will fare against New Zealand?
Well, I look at it, based on last week, we're going in rude health. Confidence will be high. They look to have real energy about them, real speed of thought and speed of body. And, you know, New Zealand are a quality side. They've got a really nice balance between the experience of guys like Sam Whitelock and Beauden Barrett to some of the newer names, the likes of Papali'i and Blackadder in the second row of around 10 caps each, or in the back row of around 10 caps each. So, but I think New Zealand are tired. I think, you know, reading the quotes from them, they just can't wait to get home. They've had an unbelievably long season. They're living in a country with the strictest COVID regulations. And yeah, it's the end of season tour for them. So that should give us hope. And I think, I think it's going to be an unbelievable occasion. I think the Irish players will feed off the emotion of the crowd, you know, full house, Tahaka, the All Blacks in town, later kickoff. And I just think the atmosphere will be more prevalent or more important than normal, because these players have been starved of this kind of occasion for a year and a half, where the Kiwis have been back into it. So, I think it's finely balanced. And I actually, you know, I wouldn't have fancied Ireland 2 weeks ago, but looking at New Zealand against Italy, even though it was a mixed team, they struggled for long periods. And looking at how good Ireland were, I think we have a cracking chance.
We're here waiting for the Republic of Ireland game against Portugal, Bernard. And look, there are parallels when you think about the narratives around the both teams and how there's an expectation about how they play and the game plans that they decide to implement on any given day, depending on the opposition. And we're expecting the Ireland soccer team to play a style that we've been getting used to under Stephen Kenny. And likewise, we're expecting things from the Ireland rugby team under Andy Farrell. And last week, we saw a bit of that with a more expansive attacking style. Do you think that Andy's going to be brave enough to stick with that when you're going up against the All Blacks?
Yeah, absolutely. I think once you pick Gibson Park and James Lowe, you're setting your stall out to play attacking rugby. James Lowe's strength is around his ball in hand and his ability to break tackles and offload, and Gibson Park just plays really high tempo. And I think that's the future for Irish rugby, even though we've got more powerful players now with likes of Doris and Porter in the team and Kelleher. I still think we need to play fast, trust our skill set, and move opposition teams around, and as I said, play high tempo. So I don't see Farrell going back, even if it doesn't work this week. You know, it's obviously another chance to perfect it, get better from it, learn from what went wrong against a very physical and aggressive New Zealand defence. So I do believe they'll stick to their guns on that.
And just then, in terms of New Zealand, you've obviously studied them quite closely over your whole career, probably at this stage, Bernard, but particularly in the last few weeks. Do you think they're vulnerable now to a certain style of rugby?
Yeah, look, I think they are vulnerable at this time of year because, as I said, fatigue. But I don't... Look, England beat them very convincingly in the World Cup with power. I don't think we can do that. We've got to play smart, and we've got to be very, very good defensively, and that's something that Simon Easterby will take a lot of hope from last week. Japan are coached by New Zealanders. They play a similar style of game as New Zealand, and we took away their time and space. And you know, the only challenge we have is that New Zealand probably have better ball players. So, you know, we saw Gary Ringrose blitz defense a few times last week, and he got man and ball. You would sometimes worry that the All Blacks will understand that depth they need, or have the ability to get that ball away and around on the outside. And if they do start getting those soft corners on the edges, then, you know, your front five are backtracking, scrambling back, and you lose a lot of energy and you lose the capacity to go and get them the second time. So that's the challenge. But I do think, you know, Ringrose, Aki, Sexton, there's a lot of experience there. Conway was very good last week. Hugo Keane, the fullback, looks really assured. So hopefully we have enough about us to get stuck into them and challenge them and ask questions of their defence, because you know, they're playing a winger at 13, Ione, and I think that could be an area of potential weakness. Plus, they've gone with Richie Mwonga on the bench, and Bowden Barrett at 10, and his brother Jordy Barrett at fullback. Bowden Barrett's an unbelievably good player, but he's not the best goal kicker, or hasn't been over the last couple of seasons. So, you know, that's a potential area of advantage for Ireland.
And Bernard, anyone that is going to be here tonight is going to get a sense of what it feels like to be in the stadium on the eve or the night of a big occasion, and just everything that goes with it. For the New Zealand players who are going to be playing against their home team, how are they going to be able to channel that emotion? Because you can even sense it already when it is starting to fill up, and there's an expectation of a certain type of performance that it brings a massive amount of pressure.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of pressure. It's going to be incredible, obviously, occasion for Gibson Park and James Lowe. And, you know, but I think that they're experienced in their own right now. They'll have crave this opportunity, and I think they'll feed off the energy and atmosphere in the crowd, and hopefully it brings the best out of them. And that's where you want to be. You want to be playing against the best teams in the world, at test level, in front of packed houses. And I don't think they'll be worried about underperforming. I think they'll just be embracing the opportunity.
And just in terms of New Zealand then, and I guess maybe the hold that they used to have over Ireland and lots of other nations, do you feel now that psychological edge has kind of gone off them a bit?
A little bit, but still massive respect and fear of what they can do to you if you let them play. So they still are the scalp I think everybody wants in world rugby, and certainly for these Irish players that have had one eye on this fixture for a long time. Definitely beating them once makes it more likely and easier to beat them the second time. But having said that, this match will be a contest in its own right, and you know, it's there to be won for both teams. The All Blacks obviously go to France the week after, which is going to be a huge test for them. But in my opinion, this is the game of November series for us, and you know, it's worth throwing everything we have at it.
Absolutely. Bernard Jackman, thank you so much. David Snaid is still sitting here beside me on Ronaldo Watch. He doesn't have, hasn't seen him yet, but he does have team news.
Not quite on Ronaldo Watch. I'm a grown up.
You know, you're a Manchester United fan, though.
I know. No, sorry, I was actually just scrolling through there and saw that the Portugal team is coming through there. And it's interesting now, we mentioned it beforehand about Cancelo, and like, obviously Man United fans will know the damage he can do with those crosses in, like anyone in the Premier League. Cancelo doesn't play, which is interesting. Obviously, he's on a yellow card. If he picks up a booking, he missed that Serbia game. So too Ruben Diaz. He's out as well. So Pepe starts. Danilo is in there. Diego Dalot, obviously, of Manchester United. It looks like he'll play as a right wing back. Anybody who has watched Man United play will know that is an area that you can exploit in behind him. I think in the last game against Atalanta in the Champions League, when he started for Manchester United, he got absolutely torn to bits with a bit of pace for down that side. Will Chidozie Ogbeni be on that side? Is he capable of kind of doing it in League One with Rotherham? Can he do that? You would imagine that's going to be an area that Ireland will try and exploit.
Okay, David Snaid, thank you so much. We're going to take a very quick break.
Game on 2FM. With Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour. 2FM.
The Republic of Ireland versus Portugal. A game on special.
Now, welcome back to our extended show this evening, live from the Aviva Stadium. We are now going to turn our attention to Gaelic games, to hurling, actually. And a little bit earlier, I spoke to Peter O'Connell, the author of Game of My Life, and it was all about the Clare hurlers from the last 30 years. Peter O'Connell spoke to several of them about the game that defined their lives. And I began by asking him how enjoyable it must have been to put it together.
Game on. Hurling.
Yeah, I have to say, Marie, it was a real pleasure to, work with the former players and some current players on this. And I suppose the thing that really struck me was the level of trust that the kind of that I felt as regards this, because some of the stories are actually, they're quite personal stories. And players really, I suppose, spoke very honestly about, some very good times and some very challenging times, both on the field and off the field. So, yeah, I felt, as it went on, Marie, I actually felt a growing sense of responsibility, I suppose, to, make sure that each player that kind of committed themselves to telling their story, that it was, presented in a way that reflected, I suppose, the honesty and the insight that they brought to it.
Was there anyone that really surprised you, like anyone that you just weren't expecting them to pick that?
Well, Ollie Baker's story definitely surprised me, I have to say. I did with most of the people in the book, I sent Ollie a text, outlined what it was about, and he got back to me and said, yeah, he'd take part, no problem. But he really got what it was about, because when I actually rang Ollie in to do the interview, he said, listen, I've been thinking about this. And he said, I think I'm going to talk about the day I made my full debut for Clare. So I was thinking, fair enough, that seems fairly straightforward. But it actually turned out that this was February of 95. He made his first start for Clare in a league match against Leash, in Port Leash. And he was told on the Thursday night that he was going to be starting midfield, told by Gerlach Nan. But unfortunately, it coincided with his grandmother's death. So, and his grandmother's funeral then was on the Sunday, as was the match. So Gerlach Nan assumed Ollie wasn't going to be going to the match. So that was grand anyway. Morning of the match and the funeral arrived, and Ollie's father said to him, listen, what are you doing here? Why are you not going to the match? So Ollie was a bit stunned, and he said, well, obviously I'm here for I'm going to my grandmother's funeral. So his father said, no, definitely go to the match. So anyway, Ollie's uncle dropped him to West County. The bus was gone. If people know the geography of Clare, the next stop, Clare Castle, Newmarket, Bunratty, the bus was gone from all of these places. So Ollie's uncle, when he got to Bunratty, said, listen, I'm going to have to turn. I have to go back to my mother's funeral. What are you doing? So Ollie said, I'm going to Tum. So he literally got out with his couple of hurleys in his bag, and as he said himself, stuck his thumb out in front of Bunratty Castle, got a lift as far as Cardavan, got a second lift in as far as out the Nina Road, and then was left there for about half an hour and thought, definitely not going to happen at this stage, until suddenly a car passed him out and then screeched to a halt, reversed back. The car was already packed with people, but, and as you know, Ollie's, quite a strapping lad. The man managed to literally bundle Ollie into the back and off up the road. They got as far as the racket hall near Ross Gray, and Ollie happened to just look out the window and see the Clare bus that stopped for a bit of a break. So he gets out very thankful. It was actually John Casey from North Clare who gave him the lift, so he's very thankful to John. Gets out, meets a temporarily stunned Gerlach Nan. As you know, Ger wouldn't be stuck for words on too many occasions, but Ollie claims on this occasion Ger had his mouth wide open, wasn't saying anything for a few seconds, because he had just told another player that he was going to be starting instead of Ollie. So then he said to Ollie, what are you doing here? And how did you get here? So Ollie told him how he got there. And Ger said, okay, he says, you're starting today. So Ollie started, Clare won well. He scored 5 points, 4 from play. And actually a really nice little point, he scored a point from a line ball as well. The next time he scored a point from a line ball was in the All-Ireland final 8 months later in Croke Park. So it was quite an inauspicious start in one way, and what a finish then to 95.
Absolutely. And look, you mentioned Gerlach Nan there, and these books are often great for like the low-key stories and the players that you might not know that much about, but having somebody like Gerlach Nan in it just makes a box office.
Honest to God, Marie, when I was talking to Ger, he was speaking with such passion and such conviction that I actually felt that I was in Páirc Uí Chaoimh, he was talking about the 1997 Munster final. I kind of felt transported back to that day. And the way in which he described setting, you know, he described it as like a coliseum, the old Páirc Uí Chaoimh. You know, the stands were so really, really dwarfed, I suppose, the playing field. And he said, like, all you could literally see was the field. He said you couldn't see anything else. And just the way he described it. And I felt as if I was transported back there. And he said he himself, as he was speaking about it, felt the same thing. So hopefully when people read the likes of that story, that they'll feel, you know, that they can actually sense, even though it was many years ago, they can sense the likes of that occasion. But there was other stories as well, Marie. I think the likes of Conor Ryan, for example, who unfortunately had to retire early, you know, was really told a really, really lovely story, poignant in a lot of ways, given that he had to retire early. I suppose one of his regrets was that he didn't get to play with his brother Dermot at either club or county level. But the one thing that the likes of Conor doesn't feel is any regret. You know, he doesn't feel sorry for himself in any way. And that was, I was kind of really impressed by that. You know, he's not like woe is me type thing. He felt like that he, you know, achieved a lot in a short period of time. And then when he had to retire at a very early age from hurling, that other opportunities opened up for him, I suppose, education-wise and work-wise and that.
It's a great insight as well into rivalries and just what it means to people to beat certain teams. And it's not just a county level as well, it's at club level and at schools level as well. And I was surprised that David Ford's one was that when his school Scariff beat St Flannan's, and obviously St Flannan's being the mighty hurling school, and I'm not even sure if everybody would have heard of Scariff, but it's a very small place in East Clare, a lot of good hurlers, but it wouldn't be an academy for hurling like the way Flannan's would be.
Absolutely. And when I got in touch with David, you know, I was expecting him to maybe talk about, for example, that 97 Munster final where he scored a goal. He scored a couple of points in the 97 All-Ireland final as well. And, you know, played in loads of big games for Clare over the years. But yeah, the one he picked was that 1990 Munster College's final, and it was an A final. They played Flannan's. Flannan's were full of massive names, including the likes of Ollie Baker. I think Fergal Hegarty was on that team as well. And whereas Scariff, most of the players playing for Scariff Community College were from much smaller East Clare clubs, but they just really seemed to get it together that year, like, and play to a really high level. And the funny and kind of poignant thing about it was that only David and Pat Minogue kind of subsequently went on to play for the county, even though he felt that they had plenty of players in that team that could have played at you know, maybe under 21 or senior for Clare, but he felt it just really wasn't part of the culture. But it was a real window in time, Marie, like, and a time that, you know, a lot of these small, some, you know, unrecognised clubs on a broader level, but clubs that do such great work themselves produced a really good kind of cohort of players. And yeah, it was lovely to, I suppose, get away from maybe some of the bigger games that we remember and to get a bit of insight into a year like that for Scariff.
Yeah, and you get to see as well how much the club means to everybody, because there's people in there with All-Irelands, and for them, their game of their lives was one that was really significant to the club, whether it was the likes of Tony Kelly, and for me, Jerry McInerney and Six Mile Bridge and Dunloy in 1996, like, that for me was probably one of the memories that I'm going to have for the rest of my life, even though I was really young back then.
I absolutely, I worked for Jerry for 18 years in the Clare Champion, and I never knew this about him until he told me in the interview that back in, he acknowledged that he wouldn't have been maybe the first person at training when he was a player in terms of the physical work. Like, he loved the hurling and obviously was an extremely talented hurler, but, you know, maybe when it came to the bit of running, that wasn't as big a fan of that. But back in 94, 95, he decided at 95, 96, he was coming towards the end of his career, and there was basically a racetrack or a track for training horses at the back of his house, and there was a sand track and a grass track, and he basically used that to build up his fitness, went in, did a few laps, did maybe 5 or 6 miles, ended up, you know, incredibly fit, and he went on then to play a really important role in helping Six Mile Bridge to win that All-Ireland club. So I suppose small little things like that, Marie, kind of things that, you know, go on with individual players and individual clubs that kind of get maybe, you know, get a bit lost. It's just nice to get these little bits and nuggets. You mentioned Tony Kelly as well. What I really admired about Tony, as great a player as he is, Like he didn't really talk much about himself. He spoke about the players in the Ballyhale club, and as you know, they're playing the county final this weekend, who keep the club going year after year. Club players who maybe haven't played for the county wouldn't be, you know, recognised as much as the likes of Tony or the likes of, you know, maybe Niall Deasy and players like that, but just give everything to the club on a year by year basis. And he sees them as, I suppose, the kernel of his club. And, you know, he's got great admiration for them. So it was quite an eye-opener to hear that from the likes of him.
It really was. And I did love all the club stories. But I like what it is as well is that it's great to actually, you kind of nearly sit back and think, like, Clare Ireland has came so far, like an awful lot has been achieved at county level and at club level as well. And it's all kind of packed in there. And it's just, you get those little different snippets and insights into how different players were feeling at that time. And, you know, just to have it all in there together is brilliant.
Yeah, I hope that each chapter has a little nugget, Marie, you know, and the likes of Nathie Jordan, for example, told a story of his time, one of his very first games for Whitegate. He won a ball out near the sideline. The match was on, I think, on a Saturday evening in Fecal. So Nathie wins this ball. He's about 16, so it's one of his first adult games. Turns, hits it, and as the ball is in flight, but not actually yet gone over the bar, next thing the Angelus bell in Fecal starts to ring, so it's time for the Angelus. Referee blows his whistle and everyone had to stop and say the Angelus before play resumed. And Nathie still remembers that the ball did actually go over the bar, but it hadn't gone over before the whistle went, so it didn't count. And the referee threw the ball in, you know. So you have these little things. Fergie Toohey then on the morning of the 1995 All-Ireland final. I don't want to exaggerate now. I was going to say he nearly got electrocuted. That might be a slight exaggeration, but he was the last person in his house in Clarecastle. His family had all left. And so he gets up and goes into the shower, and the fuse just, the shower blew up. There was a big flash. So Fergie had no shower on the morning of the All-Ireland final, but he left a note on the table, and his aunt was coming to mind the house, as they say, later that day. So he left a note, just said, don't go near the shower, shower faulty, gone to Dublin to bring back Liam McCarthy. You know, that's the note he left, you know. Yeah. And just those little bits of insights. And, you know, likes of Anthony Daly then spoke about a game that he was manager in back in 2005 that still lives with him. Clare lost the All-Ireland semi-final. The same with Brian O'Connell, who, you know, was really, it's one of my favourite entries, Brian O'Connell, I have to say, you know, really revealed a lot, I suppose, about himself. And, you know, some of it was quite a testing time as captain of Clare back in the late, back around 2007 2008 2009, that period, you know. So hopefully, Marie, there's something in each chapter like that people would get something from.
Yeah, and it's doing really well. Like, that's the thing as well, at a national level it's flying off the shelves, and it just shows as well how much interest people have in Clare hurling, and the amount of characters that we've produced in the last few decades too.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, anybody interested in sport, I always feel, okay, this book to me wasn't going to be like about, you know, what did you score and what was the score at halftime or anything like that. Everyone knows all that, like, and, you know, we can, if we need to find out all that, it's all there online. I kind of felt, let's just have a bit of a conversation with people and just to see where they were at that time. So, you know, as people as much as anything else. And, you know, like Niall Gilligan told a story about how, you know, he spoke about how his mother passed away when he was very young. She passed away in 1992. And then in 1997, then when Clare won the All-Ireland, he had just met Michael Holleran, also from Six Mile Bridge, on the field. And Michael had lost his parents, you know, fairly recently to that time as well. They just had a little chat. You know, and it was kind of literally minutes after the All-Ireland final, and it just had that moment. And I suppose you get those kind of little insights and little moments, and we realise that, you know, everyone that plays the game at whatever level it might be, they're human, like, and they have things going on in life outside of sport. And when you get that bit of insight, I just think you learn a lot more about the person that really, I suppose, hopefully proves fairly interesting. I think that applies to any sport.
Agree. Well, it's a brilliant book. Total credit, yeah, and total credit as well to all the people who contributed it. Thanks so much, Peter. And for anyone who is just tuning in, it is Clare, Game of My Life, and available in all good bookshops now.
Thanks, Marie.
Game On on 2FM. With Green Fern. Have your dinner ready in a flash. With Green Fern's high-protein cooked chicken breast fillet. Available in selected stores nationwide. 2FM.
The Republic of Ireland versus Portugal. A Game On special.
Welcome back to the Aviva Stadium, where excitement is building. You can forget about Ronaldo because it is Stephen Kenny who is the man in demand. He spent the last 15 minutes signing autographs and posing for selfies. He has opted to go for a 5-2-3 tonight in his team. Bazunu in goals, Stevens, Egan, Duffy, Coleman and Doherty across the back. Cullen and Hendrick in the middle. Ogbeni and McGrath supporting Robinson up front. Kenny Cunningham is sitting beside me. He's about to go for a sandwich, but I have distracted him for long enough here to get his reaction to the team. Kenny. Oh, no, we can't hear Kenny, so I'm going to go to Pat Fenlon, who is sitting beside me as well. Pat, just your reaction to the team.
I think it's a strong team. I think going back to the last game, Ogbeni stays in the team, played really well. McGrath the same. So like you said, he'll give that support to Robinson. Cullen is probably nailed himself down now as a starter for every game as a, in a holding midfield position. And then the Stevens and that left wing back and probably the one change. And Coleman coming in instead of at centre-half, right-sided centre-half. So instead of Omobamadele. So it's a strong-looking team. There's a bit of continuity about it now, so and looking like Portugal have probably left a few out as well, which may help us.
Absolutely. We see that João Cancelo is on the bench and so is Ruben Dias, but of course Ronaldo is in there and so is Bruno Fernandes. Well, we are going to head to the news now. We'll be back shortly to continue our build-up to this game here at the Aviva Stadium.
Live across the nation, this is RTE 2FM.
The Republic of Ireland versus Portugal. A Game On special.
The man open left.
Game On. Iron America.
Okay, now it is time to turn our attention to American sports. It's that time of the week where we check in with Jeff Shepherd, or as I like to call it, the Aaron Rodgers slot. Chef, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. A long time running American soap opera as the Rodgers turns, you know?
It's been an eventful few days for him. So just bring us up to speed. Where are we at with him now?
Yeah, so, all right. So he missed last week's game because he tested positive for the coronavirus. And the Packers wound up losing to the Kansas City Chiefs in a pretty low-scoring game. And, you know, the quote-unquote heir apparent, Jordan Love, played the whole game for him. And he wasn't great. He wasn't terrible. He was just kind of, you know, I mean, the Packers kind of left some scoring opportunities on the field. But back to Rodgers for a second here. So he is anticipating that he's going to be playing this week, interestingly enough, against another returning quarterback in Russell Wilson for the Seattle Seahawks, who's coming back from a broken finger. But Rodgers, you know, did some media last week and kind of gave the impression that, like, you know, he had been honest about his vaccine status when he really hadn't. And he said he'd been following the protocols to a T, but there had been some, you know, videos, obviously in press conferences where, you know, he may not have been wearing a mask. And so there was just some kind of questions. And then he went on the Joe Rogan podcast and talked about some of the things that he had done. And he went out and said this week, early on this week, on another podcast, which is hosted by a former NFL player, that he apologized and he didn't want to mislead anyone for any of the things that he had said. And he said he's not anti-vax. He has been getting tested. He's allergic to some of the one of the ingredients that's in one of the vaccines, in the Moderna and the Pfizer one. And he didn't feel comfortable taking the Johnson & Johnson one. So he has been getting tested daily, including on his days off. And he just, you know, he wanted to just kind of go out. He took a little bit more responsibility this week than he did last week. And he feels like, you know, he's kind of being unrightfully targeted because he's not been vaccinated. And so, again, he's expected to return this week. I'm not sure, though, if he's – I don't think he's really practicing right now. I mean, it may be one of those things where he just kind of – you know, he's so in tune with the offense and he trusts all the players and the players trust him that he kind of just, you know, shows up and plays on Sunday and they just take it from there.
And just in terms of the reaction to what's been happening with him and I guess the fact as well that he had to admit that he misled people with his vaccination status, how have people in America been reacting to him?
So he's a public figure. You know, he's kind of more of a public figure, Marie, because of all the things that you and I have talked about over the last 6 months, whether it's been Jeopardy or, you know, the State Farm, which is a big insurance company in the United States. You know, he's kind of their one of their spokesmen, along with Patrick Mahomes. And so he's, you know, he's a little bit more popular, I think, than a regular kind of NFL player. You know, I mean, those of us that follow sports, we all know who he is. But, you know, for regular quote unquote Americans that maybe aren't the biggest sports fans, he's, you know, he's still well known because, you know, you see him on commercials and you see him in different places. And so, you know, he is a kind of an easy target when a guy who's this popular, you know, tests positive for it and, you know, has to kind of hear about it all throughout the week. I mean, it's one of those stories, Marie, that it just doesn't go on ESPN. It makes its way to CNN and the other 24/7 news channels. So it's just, he's just out there more than maybe, you know, a wide receiver or a kicker or some interior lineman that you don't ever see their face. He's the face of the Packers. He's quite honestly the face of the NFL in some situations, you know? So it's just more amplified. The news is louder and more widespread just because of who he is. So it's been a topic of discussion on every show, in every show on SportsCenter, you know, since it's happened. So it's a little bit more than normal, I would say.
He has a famous partner as well, and she has been, I guess, adding a little bit of fuel to the fire, you could say.
Yes, she has. So he's engaged to the actress Shailene Woodley, who is, you know, currently starring on an HBO show with Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman, you know. So, I mean, she's a well-known actress as well. And so there was this story came out last week that maybe Aaron Rodgers, since he wasn't playing in Green Bay or playing in Kansas City, that's where the game was, he had flown out to go see her in Los Angeles. And, you know, there was a guy walking around with a mask and had some long hair, and there was a picture taken of it. And everybody just jumped to the conclusion that it was Aaron Rodgers visiting her. And she kind of came out and said, you know, some things like, you know, no offense, but this isn't him. You know, Aaron has very hairy hands, which I thought was, I don't think that's necessarily a compliment, but that's kind of one of the things that she said to, you know, differentiate the fact that this wasn't him. And she also spoke about the size of the guy's feet versus Aaron's, and we'll just let everybody draw their own conclusions on what that means. And, you know, that this guy drives a car that Aaron wouldn't drive. It was just really weird. And I think she was just upset, you know, people were attacking her man and she just had enough, but it didn't help anything. Let's just say that.
Yeah, it definitely created an awful lot of headlines. And look, I actually can't remember a time, Shep, when we were talking about on-field action. We're in a situation where it's just constant controversy and mostly surrounding COVID. But look, that's the situation that we're in. And just in terms of how the Packers have been treated compared to other clubs, because we have seen in the past other clubs breaking COVID regulations and getting pretty severely punished. Have things started to relax over there now, or are they still quite stringent when people do things that are against the COVID protocols?
So, you know, the protocols, we've talked about them. I mean, they are put in place to incentivize people to get the vaccine. You know, again, he's had to take 300 tests, basically, is what he's said in the interview this week. I mean, I would think that the protocol, like the fines or punishments, would be a little bit harsher this year because we have vaccines. Now, look, this one's hitting a little close to home, and I put it in my note to you guys when we were talking about topics, because last year when there were no vaccines, there was a video surfaced of the New Orleans Saints dancing in the locker room after a win, and some of the players didn't have a mask on, and the Saints got fined a draft pick. And the Packers got fined. Look, I mean, they got fined $300,000. That's real money. I'm not going to say that it's nothing. But a draft pick is a real serious thing. And, you know, we have vaccines now, and it just seemed odd to me. I mean, there was another player that got fined for the Dallas Cowboys this week for having his jersey untucked. Now, it was like his fourth offense, but he got fined almost as much as Aaron Rodgers did personally for, you know, contracting the virus and you know, talking, you know, doing some of the things that we've talked about. So it's still a little kind of hit or miss when it comes to the NFL and their punishments and how they, you know, dole those things out, that I don't know if we'll ever get, you know, a full, you know, understanding of what Roger Goodell does. But, I mean, look, this is the biggest, highest profile, most famous player to go through this. Not sure if we'll see another one deal with it. You know, the chances are pretty high that we probably will. But I think there's probably going to be some lessons learned about how to conduct yourself and what you can and can't say, you know, from former, you know, future players that could potentially test positive.
Learnings, they call them, Shep.
Yes.
So just a sports term that gets thrown around so much. Just on Odell Beckham Jr. then, so like he obviously is a free agent and he's looking for a team. Where do you think he's going to end up?
Yeah, so, you know, he was so popular in New York when he was there, and then he goes to the Cleveland Browns, and it just never really worked out over there for him. I mean, he was there for three seasons, and you know, quite honestly, he had about one full season's worth of catches and yardage in those 3 years. So they mutually, you know, decided to part ways, and so he cleared the waiver wire on Monday into Tuesday, and here we are on Thursday. I mean, look, I don't imagine he's going to sign with the team and play this weekend. He could potentially sign with the team today and then land and play potentially or as early as next week. And the three teams that, and ironically, one of them are the Green Bay Packers. The other one is the Kansas City Chiefs, and obviously we know about Patrick Mahomes. And look, they've been struggling, you know, just no doubt about it. They are not the high-powered offense that they've been. And then the other one is his hometown team, which happens to be the New Orleans Saints. And so those are the three teams that his agent or team has kind of leaked out, that those are the three spots that he's interested in going to. Two of them are going to be Super Bowl contenders. The Saints, you know, he would be the number one receiver on that team because Michael Thomas is not going to play this year. But, you know, Jameis Winston is now out for the year, and they've got, you know, they're going to have quarterback issues all year long. He may want to go to Patrick Mahomes or Aaron Rodgers and go play with one of those guys. And real quick, Marie, literally just as we are kind of talking right now, Cam Newton has re-signed with the Carolina Panthers. So after he got released by the Patriots earlier this year, and he's been out of football for the last 7 or 8 weeks, he has re-signed with his former team, the Carolina Panthers, who are in need of a quarterback because Sam Darnold is hurt.
Right, so it's all happening, Shep, then. And just in terms of the action, because as I said, we never get to talk about it anymore. It was a couple of years ago we had, you know, a proper preview every Thursday night. Just how have you found the season so far?
Look, I mean, it's been great. I mean, look, you know, the Packers lose to the Saints in week one. They just lost this week to the Chiefs. They've been playing phenomenally. The Dallas Cowboys are better. The Buffalo Bills, I don't know if they're the best team in the league, but they're pretty good. You know, you've got the Rams and their high-powered offense with Matthew Stafford out there now, and they're playing really well. And look, you know, there's always that old guy in Tampa still, you know, and the Bucs. They were off last week, but the Saints get upset by the Falcons, and so they're back to being the first-place team in the NFC South and maybe the best team in the NFC. So, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the teams that we thought were going to be really good are very good. The bottom of the league has continued to be the bottom of the league between the Jets and the Jaguars and the Houston Texans. But this OBJ drama and Aaron Rodgers has kind of overshadowed everything really the last 2 weeks. But yeah, it's nice every once in a while to just talk about, you know, who's playing well, and, you know, and then obviously all the situation with the Raiders as well and everything they've had going on. They've had maybe potentially the worst month in the history of the league off the field between John Gruden and the accident with one of their players where a woman was killed, and they just cut another guy who was doing some stupid stuff on social media. So they've had a really tumultuous month.
Okay, well, Shep, hopefully we'll get back on track soon. Thank you, as always, for joining us, and enjoy the weekend.
Thank you, you too.